I am Jake Peel, and I am an alcoholic. And you might have noticed I had my own little moment of silence there. I always ask God to speak through me, because what I say got me here. You know? The best thing I could say got me right where I'm at right now, and that's not a bad place. You know, it could have been a whole lot worse. But I always ask God for that help. You people taught me that. I didn't know that when I came here. And you might have noticed I do use my full name. I was basically told, once I admitted I was an alcoholic, it was unanimous, because everybody else already knew I was, so why not use my full name? Made sense to me, you know? I was brought up kind of old school. I was taught to dress up, not for you, not for me, but for respect of those who came before me, you know? And that's what I do today. You know, it doesn't hurt one bit. It's actually an honor and a privilege, like I've told some people, to be invited anywhere today. I used to be told, you know, you don't need to come back here, you know, again, ever. I was escorted out of countries. That doesn't happen today, you know. I can go anywhere in the free world today, and probably not in a free world if I really wanted to, you know. I don't have to worry about those things today because I'm a free man. You know, I've got my freedom today, and I can do anything I want, as long as I'm willing to pay the price. There's just some things I'm not willing to pay the price for today. I brought my old book with me, and there's a little story behind that. You know, it's kind of falling apart, parts coming out. Anybody want to read a little bit of how it works? It's right there, you know. Chapter 3, you know, we agnostics, doctrine of opinion. Might have been used once or twice, or hundreds or times, you know, whatever. But I take that with me, because that you'll hear a little bit more about that. But like I said, thank you to the group, and especially Billy, for inviting me over here this evening and allowing me to share a little bit of my experience, strength, and hope with you. And thank you guys for coming with me. Keep me honest, you know. The other neat thing is it's a meeting on the way over here, a meeting here, and a meeting on the way back, you know. Bam! You know? But anyway, I was born up in the mountains up in Pennsylvania around Somerset a long time ago. And back then, I was born October 10th, 1952. I don't care. I'm not afraid of my age. You know, doesn't bother me, no. But I was born to lower middle class parents. My dad worked for the telephone company. And my mom didn't work at the time. A lot of people didn't back in the 50s, you know. She tried to make a few extra bucks here and there, selling china and things over the years. You know, different things they did then. But Dad was a breadwinner, and he was a hard worker. And, you know, I remember we built a house when I was just a few years old, and I kind of almost remember a little bit about that house. But a lot of houses up there had cellars. And when I got sober out in California, and I'll tell you about that in a little while, and we don't have cellars out there, you know. So when you talk about a cellar, you say, what are you talking about? You know, but anyway, down in the basement, in the cellar, there'd be a fruit cellar, possibly, and which a lot of times was built underneath the front porch or something, you know, stuff around it. It was always cool, you know, and you kept the canned goods down there, and the wine, and the beer, you know. And that's just what people did. Because up here we don't have, you can't go out and buy beer at a convenience store or wine, you know. There were beer distributors. But we did have drive-through beer distributors. You could drive in there in your pickup truck and say, load her up, write them a check, and drive out the other end, you know. So you could do that. But I remember first drinking as a very young child in my dad's arms, and he'd give me a little sip of wine before I'd go to bed. Don't know if I had problems sleeping. Don't have a clue. You know, Dad died long before I got sober, so I really don't know. And it just doesn't matter. But I remember that. You know, that's what matters. And it was the good stuff. It was Mad Dog. Mogan David, excuse me. Mogan David Concord Gray. Mad Dog. Mad Dog. But anyway. And Dad always kept beer around the house. You know, everybody did. You know, you get done working, have a cold beer. I only ever saw my dad tipsy once. And that was when I was in high school. We were at some friend's house at the lake. They were having a party. He asked me if I was driving home. I said, sure, I can. Why? He said, well, I think I'm going to have a few more drinks. Okay. A few more drinks. Now, he wasn't stumbling down drunk by any means. You know, he had a few more drinks. So he was comfortable with me driving home. Okay. My mom, I don't think I ever saw drunk. My grandma on that side of the family, she used to have a beer or two after bingo. Grandma liked her beer. And she'd go to bingo and drop me off at the movies, and I'd go meet her back at Eagles or wherever bingo was, and then we'd stop at whichever local bar or whatever, and she'd give me a pizza, and she'd have a couple more beers, you know. Whatever. My grandpa on that side of the family, on my mom's side, he drank a little Rolling Rock pony, those little green ponies that they had back when, the original ponies, way back when. He drank one or two of those every now and again, maybe around Christmas time. And he'd dig out of the corner cabinet. We had a corner cabinet in the kitchen. I don't know whether you folks ever had those, but big old thing with dishes and kept everything in there. And down underneath there was a gallon jug. It had some clear liquid in it. It was distilled liquid in it. And he'd throw a little bit of charcoal in there, take the oil off it, you know, and pour him about half a water glass of that on New Year's. And that's the only time he ever drank. I don't know. I don't ever remember him being drunk. That's all he ever drank. You know, that was kind of his wash out the old stuff and bring in the new, you know. My grandparents on the other side, I never knew my grandfather, but he ran bars in New Jersey. I don't think he was a drunk. I never heard anything bad about him in that. My grandmother I knew, she was just a very nice, sweet woman. My dad was brought up in those bars. He didn't want anything to do with them. There's a kind of a famous hotel down along the Delaware River down there, the Indian Rock Hotel that, you know, my grandparents owned when I was a little kid and stuff. And, it's just a nice touristy place. He owned the Brookside Inn in Milford, New Jersey, you know, these type of places. You know, not Joe's Bar and Grill, you know, no, nothing good like that, you know, just normal places. But Dad didn't want anything to do with it, and maybe that's why he never drank much, you know. Where he got, you know, ripped or whatever. Don't have a clue. So, I guess what I'm trying to say by that point is, I can't blame any of this on them. You know, I'm responsible for my own alcoholism. Imagine that. My family was dysfunctional. Till I moved out and joined the Navy and left. Then they became pretty functional. You know? So, and it's true. You know, I've got to take responsibility for my own actions today. So I traveled around a lot because Dad was trying to move up in the telephone company, and he did okay. We moved from the Somerset area to Johnstown to Erie, and then I went back down to live with my grandparents for a year back down around Somerset, Berlin. And then we moved back to Johnstown and moved a couple places around there. So I was in 9 different schools by the time I was in 9th grade. Most people think, wow, that's moving around a lot. I loved it. I was the center of attention all the time. And if you're an alcoholic like me, it likes to be the center of attention. Ta-da, here I am, you know. I had new friends all the time, you know. I could make up stories. And you wouldn't know the difference because you didn't know where I was 2 years ago. I might have been across the state or something. You didn't have a clue who I was. So I could tell those little white lies about, yeah, we're moving out to the country and my dad's going to buy me a Palomino. I remember that. A Palomino? I don't even like horses. You know? I couldn't have told you what a Palomino looked like then, but I knew that a Palomino was a cool horse. You know? I mean, it's not that I don't like him. It's one bit me. Time and I don't know. I kind of learned my lesson there, I guess. But anyway, I tell those kind of stories so the kids would think, oh man, you're moving to some place that's really cool, you know, and I could be really built up before I left there. Why am I building myself up to these folks? I'm going someplace else. I don't care about them anymore. But those are the kind of things that I had to do. You know, that's the kind of kid I was. So anyway, I finally settled into my last school in Pennsylvania there, little town of Hoovervilleville. Had 1,100 people. A lot of the towns around there were about that same size. Coal mining towns, you know. Big coal mining towns. The little ones only had a couple hundred, you know. We had 1,000 or something. You know. Actually had a hardware store and one gas station and a little diner type thing. Pretty cool. Actually, it was really nice growing up like that, you know. This place kind of reminds me of that, you know. A little bit country, got just enough conveniences, you know. Yeah, you're close enough. Yeah, we'd have to go to Somerset or Johnstown. Actually, we'd go down over the mountain down to LaVale in Maryland, down by Frostburg to the mall, because they had Sears down there, you know, when I was a kid. That was a big deal. You know, you drove an hour down over the mountain. But, you know, it was nice. I can't complain about the way I was brought up, you know. It was nice. It was really nice. So, I had a friend in high school who used to work at a little grocery store. In fact, it was an IGA that he worked at there in Hoovervilleville. And he used to give this guy an extra bag of groceries every now and again. He wouldn't ring them up, and this guy would leave a bottle underneath the seat. And it'd be something like blackberry brandy or something, you know, junk like that. But it wasn't junk then because it had alcohol. You know, we were doing good. We didn't have to go try and find somebody on a Friday night that would go buy us a six-pack, you know, that we could split. So one night I picked up a friend of mine, and we had to take my brother and sister to the basketball game. Friday night basketball games, Tuesday night basketball games, big deal. I don't know where they are around here, but they sure were there. You know, that was a big deal. And we go to the basketball game, and then Buzz and I decided to take off. And we were in a 1969 Volkswagen, brand new Volkswagen, little Super Beetle. And we took off and went back into Hoovervilleville, which is about 4 miles down the road. Left my brother and sister at the game because they were okay there. You know, we didn't worry about kids then. And they were okay and figured nobody would miss us. Went down there and grabbed that bottle of booze that was hidden back behind the IGA store. And there was a cemetery back here. There was an old boy back here digging a grave by hand, you know, at night. One of the old local yokels, you know. And we go talking to him, and we're sipping on this, and we're feeling like we're big shots, you know, and getting pretty ripped. And it starts to snow. Snows up there just as it snows around here. Come down real quick, real hard, you know, at times. And we go back to the school. And we're just happy as all get out, you know, joking, feeling good. And we left there and didn't get a quarter mile down the road, and there's train tracks come across there. And I hit a coal train with a Volkswagen. Not good. I ended up getting a cut down across here and about ripped off my ear. Some other stuff. My brother, who was sitting behind me, was okay. He got banged up a little bit. My sister was sitting over here. She broke top bone, femur or whatever. She broke that, had to have a pin in it, and Buzz sitting next to me died. The car wasn't that mangled up. He had heart problems, and he died, you know. And I remember laying there. I kind of remember, I think, hanging my head out the door and puking or whatever. Somebody was trying to see how I was. I almost remember the lights of the train. I don't know for sure. But the one thing I do remember is waking up in the hospital and asking how Buzz was. And when they said he died, I lost it. I think they put me back out then or something. I don't know. So that was December 19th, 1969. Right before Christmas. Good Christmas present, huh? A normal person would think about their drinking after that. I thought about my drinking. I thought about drinking more and more and trying to stuff those feelings. And I did that for a lot of years, a long, long time. I got out of the hospital before Christmas. My brother got out. My sister spent Christmas in there, so we all spent Christmas with her in there. Not good. But I continued on. Got asked to quit the football team. Now, this is how bad my drinking and smoking and carousing was during high school. We had 21 people on the football team. Now let's do some quick math here. 11 people offense, 11 people defense, 22 people. We had 21 people, including me, and the coach thought, I might want to quit because I wasn't showing up at practice in real good shape and, you know, a lot of other stuff going on. Normal person would have thought, might be a problem there. Try and figure out what it is. I didn't care. That just freed me up, you know. I made up some excuse to my parents, whatever. I was in the play. And it was called The Campbells Are Coming. And it was about a bunch of old hillbillies. And I put on my dad's bib overalls, and I had on a fake beard, and I had on my old felt hat. I've still got that hat. In fact, I'll wear it over here to Graves Mountain next year if you'd like to see it. But I'm serious. I was Bildad Tapp. Man, that was a long time ago. How do I remember that name? Bildad Tapp. And I was the head of the hillbillies there, you know, the old drunk. And that kind of fit. It just hit me. I never really thought about that much till just now. More will be revealed. Yeah. And that's not bad, you know. But I kind of use that as an excuse why I had to quit football because, you know, I had to put more time into the play and I was the lead character, you know, and I had to da-da-da-da-da-da. Yeah, okay. So anyway, my parents forced me off to college. I went to the University of Pittsburgh in Johnstown for a year. I think they almost had to buy me into there because my grades weren't that good. I had C's at best, you know. I mean, I just breezed through is what I did. Didn't put any extra effort in. And first term I majored in pinball. Second term I majored in poker. So needless to say, there wasn't a third term. But there could have been because, see, this was 1970, and I had signed up for aviation ROTC with the United States Navy because I loved to fly, I thought. My neighbor had an airplane. We used to go flying with him every now and again, and I just loved the thought of flying. And then apparently I ran out of vodka and some other substances that were floating around back in that time, and that's all I'm going to talk about them. And I realized I had taken all the tests. I was signed up. I had signed the contracts. I was going to be a pilot in the U.S. Navy. Uh-oh. Those of you that are of my age group might remember there was a little conflict going on about that time in Southeast Asia. Pilots weren't doing real well. I said, oh, my God, what am I going to do? So I went down to the recruiter and joined up regular. That's the only thing I could do. I had to join up. I had to do something. Because I had already made a commitment. So, being as I quit college, then I had to fulfill my commitment. I had to join up regular, you know, which I did. And that started. Well, I kind of scammed things there because I joined up in December, but didn't actually go on active duty till April because I had to take finals, which I never took. But, you know how we are. Anyway, you fill in the blanks. Yeah, just make up something. It's probably pretty close to what happened, you know. It's just not that big a deal. The result was I fell in lust. Pam and I were going to have a baby. We got married. Told our parents a couple days before. Got married on Friday, April 23rd. Went to boot camp Monday, April 26th. So, yeah. Anyway. So, that was a marriage made in heaven. I'll talk more about her in a little while. Reese has met her. And that's a story in itself. But we got married. I finished boot camp, and I became an electronics technician in the Navy. The reason I wasn't an aviation electronics technician because I would have had to go to Millington, Tennessee from boot camp, and right after boot camp, and then take a couple weeks leave. Well, I had just gotten married, you know, a couple months before that. I wanted to go home. So if I went to be a straight electronics tech, I got to go home and then come back to Great Lakes. So I did that. We moved up to Great Lakes, packed everything in a 1968 Dodge Coronet 500. Up the highway we go, you know. And life was about to change for both of us. For her, it's a shame, you know, because she is a very nice lady. In fact, I was just talking to her earlier this afternoon. And we moved up there, had a baby, my son Christopher, quite the man today. He's part of my story too, and I'll tell you a little bit about that a little bit later. But he was born up there December 29th, 1971. And we ended up spending a little bit of time there, and then we left there after a year. I'd gone to a lot of schools there. Went to, we used to go to the club every Friday night, see, because I was getting $78 one paycheck and $79 the next, and that was every 2 weeks. And that was with a wife and a kid, so I wasn't making a lot of money, but you didn't need a lot of money back then. You needed a little bit more than that to survive comfortably, but we were surviving okay. You know, because the military pretty well took care of you back then. You know, it had some good benefits, you know. It was okay. We had very cheap housing, even though you could whisper and hear the other person through the walls. But, you know, what the heck? It worked, you know, for us. And we were grateful for it. But that allowed me to buy beer and whiskey and other things, you know. And it was okay. Because I used to go to the bar up in Wisconsin. See, because when she was pregnant, she could go into the grocery store and buy beer. I went to the same grocery store, and they wouldn't sell me beer because I wasn't 21. You're supposed to be 21 in Illinois at the time. So I'd go up across the border up into Wisconsin to a little beer bar up there. We'd shoot pool, get in with all these old guys, and I'd come home smashed on my butt with a six-pack of beer because I was pretty good at shooting pool at the time. So that worked out. But anyway, you know, life was fairly simple, but the drinking was happening. Friday nights we'd go over to the club a lot of times. They had, like, it was a dollar for a bottle of cold duck, big old bottle, you know. And we'd drink cold duck and throw them under the table and see how many we could stack up, you know. Real exciting stuff. But it kept me drinking. I didn't care about them. I didn't care about you. I didn't care about anybody else. It kept me drinking. Then we went overseas. Went over to Northern Ireland. There was a little issue going on in Northern Ireland in the early 70s, too. I guess I attracted this stuff. You know, but I was supposed to go over there, and they couldn't come, supposedly, because of all the troubles. And I got over there and got in with a good crowd there on the base and started really pounding them down. And they have 40-ounce mugs over there, they're pints, you know, at 40-ounce mugs. And I was drinking three shots in that of like 7 and 7 to one of her small drinks when she finally came over there 4 or 5 months later, when she finally was allowed to. And I wasn't. Didn't even faze me, you know. So I should have known there was a problem. My 21st birthday, this all before I turned 21. My 21st birthday, I remember we were playing flag football out there in the field, and I was holding the line marker, and I remember falling flat on my face, and everybody laughing, saying, "Hey, happy birthday, have another one," you know. And that's how it was, you know. That's how it was a lot of the time. I'm not going to say drinking was promoted back then, but it sure was condoned, you know. Put it that way, it was condoned. It wasn't necessarily promoted, but everything that went on, there was drinking involved. So, and I'm not blaming that on anybody either. That's just the way society was then, the way things were. And so we moved back to the States. We moved down to Driver, out in the boonies down there, partying hardy down there. Moved back overseas to Scotland. Partied hardy over there. You know, and my kid and her are coming along, so he had an Irish accent he picked up over there. And then he's got a little bit of a drawl he picked up down in Driver, down there by Suffolk. Then we go over to Scotland. Now he's got the Scottish brogue going, you know. This poor kid was all mixed up. But that's not why he was an alcoholic. He's an alcoholic either. That's his own story. He's his own admission. I'm not calling him that. But I was getting in trouble here and there. And I've got a three or four of those certificates that say 3.2 credits for Florida State University for NASAP, Navy Alcohol Safety Action Program. You used to get college credits for going to that stuff. And they used to tell me, and I laugh about it now, because exactly what they would say was, normal people don't plan on going out and getting drunk. And I'd say, bull! Do that all the time. Normal people don't plan on going out and getting drunk, is what they said. I remember hearing that many, many times. And I was always upset about that. You know? I am not normal people. I know that today. But anyway, I kind of got through all that stuff. And we moved back to the States. Things weren't going real well. I was kind of driving people away from me by that time. And I went out to California. They came out. She really didn't want to come out there. She wanted to stay in Pennsylvania. Because moved them back there. I was going to California for school for 6 months. And then we were figuring out where I was going after that. I ended up staying out there. So I talked her into moving out there with my son. She reluctantly moved out there. And she's reminded me of that. Not nasty-wise, just in conversation, you know. Which is good, because I need reminded of some stuff. I don't remember things real well. I've got a good forgetter, you know. And but once I'm reminded, I normally agree, because probably was right, you know. So that was the beginning of the end of us. I drove her and my son off. We got divorced in 1983. And I don't blame that on her one bit. That was all my doing. And I was kind of searching around then. I was wanting to talk to preachers, and I called a couple churches. I was originally brought up in Church of the Brethren, and I called a Brethren preacher out there. There aren't that many in California, by the way. A whole lot more over here. But I called him, and he, well, what do you want? Man, don't you know, you know? So I gave up. And just kept partying. And I was partying hard. I got promoted in the Navy. At the time, well, if you're familiar with the Navy at all, I made chief. Which was another big party in my initiation. I'm wearing khakis. I'm supposed to be responsible now. You know? Don't know how that happened. But I ended up being the assistant branch head for a school there that I was teaching at. I wasn't showing up at work. Not good. So twice in 1 week, the master chief and some other people came out to my house and picked me up. Well, the first time they said, you need to come in. I said, I'll be in the morning. Okay. Well, I didn't show up till about noon the next day. I figured, I don't care. So what? You know, what are they going to do to me? Could have done a lot to me. A few days later, I did the same thing. So I've got paper written up on me now. Charges. Not real good. But I knew how to get out of that stuff. I had heard about, go to this counselor, this DAPA or whatever, drug and alcohol something or other person, and go to them and tell them you got a drinking problem. And they'll send you to treatment. You can get out of trouble for some of this stuff, especially if it's alcohol related. That's cool. That's what I'll do. You know, I'm thinking about that. Yeah, got it. So I did that. And that was like on a Thursday. Actually Friday when I talked to him. And I never talked to anybody else and figured, well, it's going to be a few weeks and I'll be, you know, then they'll put me in treatment over here and everything will be cool. The following Tuesday, I was on a medevac flight from San Diego to Bethesda. They got the first bed available, and that's where it happened to be. Whoa! Let's back up here, you know? This is a little bit too quick. But what happened there was they made me buy this book. And I say this book, this exact book right here. They made me buy this book when I was there. And there was a little counselor, a little Marine gunnery sergeant. His name was Richard. You should call him Dick for short. I had to say that. Forgive me. But anyway, you know what we really used to call him. We used to switch those words around. because we were nasty alcoholics, and he used to just laugh, say, keep coming back, you know. And they took us out to some meetings. And there's some of those meetings I'd kind of like to go back to. Downtown D.C. Not in the section of town I'd probably live. You know, I wouldn't be afraid to go there right now because I've got God in my back pocket. You know, I don't care. But I wasn't real welcome around those neighborhoods. But we used to go to meetings there. And there was old boys there, you see. Because we had those bands on our arms. Of course, everybody knew where we came from, you know. We couldn't hide, you know. Other than we were all white in a black neighborhood, you know, we couldn't hide very well either, you know. But see, you guys, sit down here in the front row and shut up because you have nothing to say. Okay, we'll do that. You know, and that was kind of my introduction to AA. Didn't drive me away. I knew I had a problem. I just wasn't real willing to do anything about it. They said I could stay three weeks or 6 weeks. They had two different programs at the time. I said, cool. Scam my way out of here. Be out of here in 3 weeks. Back to California. Everything would be cool. If you keep my nose clean for a while, it'll all be good. 6 weeks later, I've got a paper here. Old, you can hear it. My discharge papers from that facility. Admission date, 22 May, 84. Discharge date, 29 June, 84. My sobriety date is 28 November, 88. I never did anything real fast, but it got me out of trouble. And on here it says, yes, I was an alcoholic. I admitted to being an alcoholic. I had, you know, some other issues. I mean, nothing outrageous. But that date of 29 June, you know, 84. When I got done with that, and back out to California, well, I had to have somebody's name for a sponsor in California before they'd let me out. Now I'm in Bethesda. So I called up a couple girls I used to drink with. You know anybody that's an AA? Yeah, we know this guy. I said, well, give me his name and phone number. You guys know who he is. Larry R. from Fredericksburg, if you know him. Larry Romero. I had his number. I never did call him. I never did really meet him until 4 years later when I sobered up. But I had a phone number. No problem. I had contacts. They let me get out of there, head back to San Diego. I got back out there, and I was still hanging around in the bars, drinking tonic and lime without the vodka, shooting darts, doing everything I wasn't supposed to do. I had to take a urine test at work once a week normally, but they always gave me a couple days' notice because I was a chief and I was a branch head. So, like, you got a test coming up next Tuesday, and they tell me like Wednesday before. Okay, thank you. Yeah, cool. I'm good, you know. So I'd watch myself for a little while. So this went on. I went to one meeting, and I used to think it was 6 to 8 months. Honest to God, 6 to 8 months that I stayed sober. It was maybe 6 weeks because I was going to a motorcycle enthusiast event in Sturgis, South Dakota, which is the first full week after the first full weekend in August. End of June, second week in August. Yeah, about 6 weeks. But honest to God, it seemed like 6 to 8 months to me. It really did. And that was even after I got sober this time, you know, and actually came into his rooms for good. I used to tell people it was 6 to 8 months. And then when I looked at things like this, dates, I said, whoa. Forgive me, I was wrong, you know. It was 6 weeks, you know. But I had, I sat in the bar a couple days before I headed up there and started thinking about it. And then somebody said, well, aren't you going to drink up there? I said, well, yeah, probably. So, well, why don't you have one here? You're right. Why not? Yeah. Makes sense to me. What am I doing around here drinking Cokes? You know, this is stupid. I'm planning on drinking up there. Why not drink before I head up there? So I did. It got ugly after that, trying to hide my drinking. Because I knew what my problem was. And I continued to drink. transferred from there to a ship. Actually, went to Millington, Tennessee to school for 7 months, which I shouldn't have gone to that school as a chief, but I scammed that one. Went there, and they never had... I was a PBR drinker, by the way. I drank good stuff. Pabst Blue Ribbon, for those of you who don't know what PBR is. My redneck, my white socks, and blue ribbon beer. Oh, don't get me started. But, you know, I was down there in Millington, and the one chief that I went to school with, he drank PBR, but they could never keep it in the chief's club. I was there a month. They were stocking PBR in the chief's club. Tell you how much I drank? Not bragging. It's just fact. He was happy. I got away with stuff in that school that nobody else could. Because now they had his beer in the cheese club. You know, they'd call me up. I'd be asleep over in my room. Hey, you got to come over and take this performance test on this piece of equipment. I'd go over there and I'd take care of it and I'd fix this equipment. He'd say, now go home. Get out of here, man, before somebody sees you. Okay, bye. And I'd go back over to my room in the barracks. You know, like I said, it wasn't necessarily, you know, they didn't enable me too much, did they? But anyway, spent... Memphis Municipal Jail does accept Visa. They did back then in like 85. They were one of the first ones because I was thrown in there and they slammed the door and next thing I know the jailer's coming back and he says, how you plan on paying for this? And I had a couple hundred bucks in my wallet. I was a single chief. You know, I'm partying down, having a good time. Living in the barracks. I had no expenses. And I said, you accept Visa? And slam! Next morning I had this thing here. Sign this. There was my $25 drunk in public Visa bill, you know. I used to have that somewhere. I don't know where it's at now. But it just doesn't matter. You know, for the next 4 years, I had problems because I had a head full of AA and a belly full of beer, and I was sick. I was just really sick. I got married again to a drinking buddy. Here's another marriage made in heaven. Going to last forever. At the Dewdrop Inn in Chula Vista, California, got married by a former judge, Paul Menard. Why am I remembering these things now all of a sudden? Wow. With the jukebox playing Willie Nelson, good-hearted woman in love with a good-timing man. That was meant to last. You know, it lasted up until a couple years ago. She supported me pretty much, you know, staying sober, and she's out there finishing her story now. And I'm just going to leave it at that. I'm not going to talk bad about the lady. I pray for her every day. She's finishing her story now. That's the best I can do. I ended up scamming one last time, got them to, when they came to my house to pick me up, they brought the shore patrol too because I was in the Navy. Took me back to the ship. I scammed them into letting me bring my car with me. The shore patrol drove my car. I didn't. Back to the ship so I'd have it because I wasn't allowed. I wasn't supposed to come home because anger issues. You know, that's another whole story. That's a half hour story in itself. There. I don't have any anger problems, but I started going to AA for me. My XO on the ship, who I worked for directly, said, do you want to go back to treatment? I said, no, sir. I said, I think I know what I need to do. In fact, I know what I need to do. I just need to do it. He said, okay, chief. Give it a try. So I did. And I had a warrant officer on there. We were out at sea one night, and he says, chief, he said, you only got like 2 years to retire, man. He said, you can just play this game for 2 years and then go out and party down. And I looked that man square in the eye. I'll never forget it. And I looked at him and I said, I don't think this time, sir. I said, this time it's for real. And he smiled and said, okay. Well, I talked to him a couple years ago on the phone because I happen to know a guy who knows him and he mentioned his name and I said, give him a call. So anyway, that was kind of neat, you know, because I did mean it with all my heart. I didn't know whether I could do it, but I meant it. I goofed around with sponsorship for about 6 months. Had a guy that was my friend. Okay, that'll work. Then I needed help because I hadn't been working the steps. I've been just going to meetings. And I have a little saying around Fredericksburg there. I said, you know, you can go to Mary Washington Hospital and hang around for 20 years and you're not going to become a doctor. You can come to these meetings and hang around for 20 years and you're not going to become sober. You're going to be dry. There's a whole lot of work you've got to do. And I truly believe that. If you don't, God bless you. That's okay. Believe what you want. But there's a whole bunch of work I've got to do to be sober. Same thing a doctor has to do. But I've got a God, and my God is so powerful. If he wanted me to be a doctor tomorrow down there at that hospital, I'd be a doctor. Because my God can do that. He can pull that kind of stuff off. I can't. But my God also kept me sober till today, till right now, from that time. That's the only thing that's kept me sober. I had a sponsor named Mike out there. Mike Mahler. I had a little bit of college. I was pretty well educated, been to a lot of schools and stuff, and Mike finished eighth grade. Wasn't intelligent. Wasn't book learned. That man was smart. He taught me more about this program than anybody else has ever to this point. And that's because Mike walked through the steps in this book with me. Not anything else. Not that there's anything wrong with the other literature. But Mike took me through the steps in this book. We started at the first page. And we went through there. We read the doctor's opinion. Oh, I forgot to give my disclaimer at the beginning. I'm going to talk about the steps in God, so if you've got a problem, go ahead and leave. It's too late now. You've been here long enough. Just sit still. But anyway. We worked through the steps. We started reading in the doctor's opinion, studying it. Mike had me going to meetings where there was more people with more sobriety. There was newcomer meetings, people with less time than me, speaker meetings. So I had to sit down, shut up, and listen. You know, and that's exactly the way it was put to me. You need to go to these kind of meetings. You sit down, shut up, and listen to somebody else's experience, strength. Well, what if I don't like what they're doing? Then don't do what they did. If you don't like what they got, you know, I've never been to a bad speaker meeting. Some just been better than others. I've never been to a bad AA meeting. Some just been better than others. You know? If you're talking about something and what you got in life isn't what I want, I'm not going to do what you did. You know? It's as simple as that. And please don't do what I did if you don't like what I have today. You know? You're not going to offend me. By no means. Well, we started out in that doctor's opinion. That explained what was wrong with me. Talked about that mental obsession. Taking that first drink. Then once I take that first drink, it sets it off. It sets off that physical craving that says more and more and more. There's only one way to keep from getting that mental obsession. That's with some spiritual help. There's a doctor in there that talks about that. I believe his name might be Silkworth or something like that. You might have heard of him. He didn't use his name in the book at first. He didn't want to attach to that stuff. But, you know, there's only one thing I can do to keep from getting that mental obsession if I have spiritual guidance. You know, I've got to be spiritually fit. And I can go anywhere. I can do anything in this world I want to, and I have. I've been a lot of places. You say, oh, man, I wouldn't go there. You know, well, why not? If I'm going for the right purpose, I can go anywhere or do anything. Mike continued to take me through these steps. Walked me through them. You know, led me. Not like, here's a four-step guide, come back in 5 weeks and tell me how you're doing. Oh my gosh. I just almost cry, you know, when I see that happening. That's what you do, fine. If that's what works for you, fine. It didn't work for me. And that's not the way I work with people. I lead them through the steps. And I know some of you have heard it, because I know some of you have been to the same meetings I've been to and heard some of the same people talk. I can take you through the steps in 4 hours. All 12 steps. And I defy you to try. Try it. Just try it. I'll spend whatever 4 hours you want to. Because that's the way the old timers used to do it. That's the way Dr. Bob and Bill used to do it. And if they can do it, I can do it. You know why? Because I was taught by the old timers. The ones who were brought up by Bill and Bob. Thank God I got sober when I did. With the people around that I did. Are you going to do the steps perfectly? No, you're not. I've been around 21 years. I'm still not doing the steps perfectly. I'm doing them to the best of my ability, the way this book says. And I follow this book. And if I do exactly what that says, and that's another guarantee I make for people. I will guarantee you, you will never drink again if you follow this program exactly the way it's written in this book. Exactly the way it's written. I'll bet you some money on that one, too. Put it out there, you know. Because I don't know about you, but I have never followed this program exactly, you know. But if you do follow it exactly, there's no way you can drink. Because it talks about some good stuff in there. You know, the first three steps, you know. Some people say, and it kept me going for a while. I can't, he can, I think I'll let him for steps 1, 2, and 3. Then I was in a stage for a while where that's pretty arrogant. I'm going to let God? Yeah, I've got to surrender to God, so I've got to let him, you know, once I realized that, you know. So it kind of made sense. The fourth step, people worry and worry about that, and fret about it if you haven't done it. The fourth and fifth, all that's doing is showing me what's wrong with me. So as it comes up, I can take care of it. That's all it is. The sixth and seventh, I've got to decide to give this stuff to God. Give it to him, you know. Make that decision. Here, you got it. You got it, God. And I don't know, it was taught to me, maybe right or wrong, indifferent, but it makes sense to me. You know, third step prayer. Say that third step prayer, there's no amen at the end of that. Then you do the fourth step. You get into some action. You do some work. You do the fifth step. You do the sixth step. Then the seventh step. At the end of the seventh step prayer, if you happen to know what's the end of that, there's that word amen. We've completed that action there. It makes sense to me. That's the way it was explained to me, and that's the way I read it in here. It works for me. Then 8 and 9. You know, we've got some more work to do. That's where I tell people, if you're worried about the 4th and 5th, don't worry about it. Worry about the 8th and 9th when you got to make amends to that guy you ripped off for $20,000. You know, face-to-face amends. Then worry about that. Don't worry about the 4th and 5th. You know, let's just get through the 4th and 5th. And that makes the 4th and 5th look a whole lot simpler, doesn't it? You know? But then I also throw in a caveat. But by the time you get to the 8th and 9th, by doing the 4th and 5th and getting some of that baggage off and realizing what's going on, you're not going to worry about the 8th and 9th. It's going to be much easier than what you really think it is. And there's a lot of ways to do that 9th step. You know, I will never complete the 9th step. There will always be amends out there that I have not made. And that's because more will be revealed. I'll be sitting in a meeting sometime and somebody could be talking. A young lady who just got sober could be talking, you know, on a Friday night down there in Fredericksburg, and I hear something and it clicks, oh man, I've got to go back and make amends on that. Oh man! So I take my 10th step and I do that. You know? I'm going to continually make amends, you know, with the 9th step. And the 10th, where I promptly admit, not at the end of the day, not 3 weeks from now. When it happens, I've got to promptly admit it. That's promptly to me. That's what promptly was taught to me, you know, as soon as possible. The 11th step talks about in there. And this was kind of funny, too, because I've started going back to a church. And one of the first nights there at a Bible study, we were going over some stuff, and I popped up with the 11th step. Sought through prayer and meditation to prove my conscious contact with God. Yeah, that's exactly what we're talking about. How'd you know that? Because it came from that same book you're using over there. You know, but no, it's just kind of funny. Everybody in my church knows I'm sober. You know, because I want to be of help to anybody. You know, they all know it. Anybody that asks knows it. Maybe not everybody, but anybody that asks, you know, I don't hide it at all. In fact, the 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, that's the only result I'm going to get. A whole lot of other good stuff that can happen in between. A whole lot of other good stuff and will happen because of that. But that's the only thing I'm guaranteed. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, that spiritual awakening is fantastic. I mean, wow! You know, I've been on some good highs in my life, but there ain't nothing like that. I've only got a few minutes left, and what I was sharing there just a little bit ago about coming over here, and I was sharing a little bit before the meeting. I was telling the men in my church, we get together and pray before church services in the morning, Sunday morning. And I go in there, and I'm not dressed anything like this. I go in there in my Harley shirt and jeans, because those are my church clothes. My pastor said, those are your church clothes. That's fine. Thank you. Whatever you're comfortable with, as long as they're clean and you're not disturbing anybody. You know, I don't wear naked lady shirts anymore. You know, I never did wear many of them, you know. But anyway, you know, neat and clean. Respectable. You know. And I told the men of that church where I was coming tonight, because right now I'm supposed to be a Bible study. We're studying 1 Samuel. That's where I normally am on Sunday nights right now. But I told them where I was coming, because I know where I need to be. And they all got around me and prayed this morning. I knew I was going to be okay. You know, what come out of my mouth, I ain't worried about it. You know, I'm going to be okay today. Because I've got every one of them backing me. You know, prayer warriors. I just touched on my son real quick and that former wife, Pam. I used to call her plaintiff number one and the other one plaintiff number two, but that ain't right. That ain't right. Pam was my first wife who I drove off. Like I said, her and I are very good friends now. She's got about 3 years in Al-Anon. She lives in South Dakota. I live here. We're very good friends. You know? And the reason? We've both got God in the center of our lives. Our son, Chris, got married, was it 3 years ago? 2 years ago. 2 years ago. He's been sober. He will have been sober 3 years, June 7th. He will be sober 3 years, June 7th. That's a miracle. That's why I said I can call him an alcoholic, because he calls himself an alcoholic. Reese came out to his wedding. Got to experience his wedding out in St. Louis area. That's a boy that wanted nothing to do with me a few years back. I watched him get thrown out of the Navy. I watched him get split up with his first wife. I watched him lose kids who really weren't his, but that's another story. I watched him go to jail. I watched him go to prison. And there's nothing I could do but just love him and pray for him, because that's what you people taught me. Just love him. That's all we can do. That's all we can do with anybody. I can't keep you sober. You can't keep me sober. I can't get you drunk. You can't get me drunk. I guarantee you can't get me drunk. I can get me drunk. But you know what? He's got God in the middle of his life. Pam's got God in the middle of her life. And I got God in the middle of my life. And we're like a family again. We've been divorced since 1983. You know, we're very good friends now. That's a miracle. That is a miracle. Because there was one point in life where I was going to call in some favors from some not so nice friends I had that lived down in North Carolina where she moved to, and have her put out of my misery. You know, and I was serious. Thank God I didn't do something like that. You know, and God led me through all that. You know, I've got an awesome God today. If you'd like to hear more about my God today, catch me after the meeting, because I'll talk about him all night long. You know, I found my way back into a church. Not saying you got to. It only took me 20 years to find my way into a church where I was comfortable. You know, I never said I wouldn't. I said I'm not ready right now. But someday I may. And I found a church that I'm comfortable in. They're comfortable with me. I'm being fed there. I can grow. I can talk about AA. In fact, we have a Saturday night meeting there now in that church. And I threw in a kind of a punch last night for the church, you know. Somebody asked me to speak, and I, you know, told them about this great church I found, and I told, by the way, it's right here. You know, you're all invited back tomorrow. But anyway, that's another story, you know. But I have not replaced my program with church, and I never intend to. And I told my pastor that I augment my program with church. I augment church with my program. Here's where I was able to find God again. Actually, which is the God of my youth, really. The God that's in the Bible. That's my God. Jesus, you got a problem with that, talk to me after the meeting. Talk to your sponsor. He'll talk to me. but anyway, no, and I've found where I'm very comfortable with that now. I can talk to anybody about that. I can talk to anybody about AA. I don't have to hide from anybody today. Like I said, once I admitted it, it was unanimous. And I need you folks more than you need me. Thanks for being here.